For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent cave dwellers you're ever going to run across, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, I'm going to show my age. I remember way back when I was a kid, the Mass was in Latin.
Isn't that a dead language?
Well, yes and no. I think it's kind of on life support, but no. When I was a kid, you know, the Mass was in Latin, and then along came this thing called Vatican II. Now, when Vatican II came around, I was starting grade school. The changes that were coming about from Vatican II were just starting to happen. I remember, for example, in first grade, there was this big blue book that sat on Sister's desk. It was the Baltimore Catechism, and that's what we were taught out of.
Good stuff.
You know, Sister was there. She had the long habit, the veil, all of that, the whole nine yards. When we went to Mass, there was a communion rail. The priest had his back to us. And then all of a sudden, when I went back for second grade, that big blue book was gone. Sister was wearing a short skirt, a white top, and some of the nuns in school weren't wearing veils anymore. So the book was gone, the habit had changed, and then we went to Mass, and wait a minute, the communion rail's gone, the priest is facing us, and wait a minute, I understand every word he's saying. What is going on here? It was a sudden shift, and then I know for the rest of my education in Catholic schools, there was a major, major confusion as to what was being taught. I mean, first and second grade, they called it catechism. From that point on in, it just became religion class. Vatican II seemed to change everything. You know, we hear the term the spirit of Vatican II. What is the spirit of Vatican II, and what's the reality of what Vatican II was meant to do?
Your story, you know, I've heard that same story from so many different people that I think everybody that lived through Vatican II has that same story of suddenly we went to Mass one Sunday and everything had changed. Or, you know, I went back to school and the Baltimore Catechism was gone, and suddenly Sister was not wearing her habit anymore. And everything had changed with that one moment of Vatican II. So the spirit of Vatican II is either a bogeyman, depending on if you're uncomfortable with all the changes that happened, or the spirit of the Vatican II is suddenly the renewal of the Holy Spirit that had been, you know, left out of the church for centuries, and suddenly the Spirit was let back into the church to renew it because the church had become ossified and dead and a bunch of dry bones.
Well, one thing's certain in my mind, which is that Vatican II is a watershed moment for Holy Mother Church, but just, you know, actually Western civilization writ large, because it's one of those decisive moments, decisive features of the 20th century, where not only did a lot of things change in Holy Mother Church, and especially in the American experience of post-Vatican II, but which had really, as you mentioned, Kent, probably the sharpest turn of events, or in terms of implementation.
You know, when you look at Catholicism, you know, over the course of its history, I mean, and, you know, just the history of the world, for the longest time, we simply divided things into B.C. and A.D. Now, we as Catholics, we have B.C. and A.D., but then, you know, we have the subcategory of A.D., which is pre-Vatican II and post-Vatican II.
Right. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to invite into the cave Dr. David Deevil, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies from the University of St. Thomas, and he's a little bit of an expert on this, so he's going to help us sort out what is Vatican II? What is the spirit of Vatican II? What do all of those documents say? And really, was this a huge dividing line in the history of the church, or was there more continuity behind it?
All right, we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
For your faith?
It's completely changed my walk with Christ, and I'm so thankful to you guys for that.
For your life?
All I got to do is turn it on, and I'm lifted up.
You lift you up when you're feeling down.
Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. And joining us now in the Catholic Cave, once again, one of our great friends of the show, Dr. David Deevil. He is the Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas up there in the beautiful state of Minnesota. You may also know him, though. He frequently publishes articles in Catholic World Report. That's where I often keep touch with him. But I also highly recommend another publication where he is the editor of, and that is Logos, which is a journal of Catholic thought and culture. If you're looking for a good, solid Catholic journal, that's one definitely to consider. We'll talk more about that later in the show. And also, Dr. Deevil is a recipient of many, many different awards, most notably to me, and this is actually how I made his acquaintance. It was through the Acton Institute, where in 2013, he was the Michael Novak Award winner. So welcome back to the Catholic Cave, Dr. Deevil.
Hey, thank you, Tim. It's good to be back with you guys.
Well, we have, I think, a super important and interesting topic today to discuss with you, and that is Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council. And you had published some articles recently with Catholic World Report, and it was fascinating kind of, I don't want to get too far ahead, but it was fascinating sort of your take on Vatican II and sort of its implications. But for the sake of our listeners, let's just talk just generally, situate us a little bit, if you would, Dr. Deevil. You know, what was Vatican II? And then from there, let's maybe back up in time and kind of maybe explore kind of what led into why they called the council, and then we'll kind of move through time in that fashion. So Vatican II, or the Second Vatican Council, what was it?
Yeah, well, for one thing, it was the conclusion of Vatican I, the Vatican Council that happened in 1870, the one that famously made the declaration that the Pope could speak infallibly under certain conditions, and also that he had a sort of general universal jurisdiction over the Church, had ended because it took place during the movement for Italian independence. So it was never actually called to a close and didn't actually get done with all the work that needed to be done. And so the church church goes on as it does, even if you don't quite finish all the things you want to at a council. But in the 1940s and the 1950s, there was a lot of ferment on the part of many theologians. They felt that there needed to be more said about the authority of bishops, not in opposition to the Pope, but alongside the Pope. They felt that there needed to be more said about the new, the new strides in biblical scholarship, new ways of thinking about how we get along with other Christians and other religions. And so there was a lot of ferment going on under the surface. By the late 1950s, many people, Pope Pius XII had been Pope for a very long time, and at his end, he was succeeded by Angelo Roncalli, a genial Italian who himself was very traditional in mindset, but also felt that there needed to be something done, and he decided to call the Second Vatican Council, a council that would complete and renew that First Vatican Council. There was a great deal of upset on the part of many people. They thought that this would just be a stage-managed Pope event. And when the Pope's, basically his office, his curia, came up with a set of documents. Many, many bishops were upset and said, well, we need to have something that's brand new. And so they worked with many theologians, some very good, some, you know, not so good, but they came up with a new set of documents for the council, 1962 to 1965. And it had four major documents and then about 13 other minor documents. And most of them are fairly good, but it took place during that time that we now know as the 60s. So there was a lot of ferment over how do we interpret these documents. And after the council, there were many directions that were gone, and some people said, this is great, let's go with what the council said, and other people said, well, that was only a beginning. We've got to change everything. And so the history of the church since 1965, when the council ended, has been one of trying to figure out what not only what Vatican II meant in general, but what it means for us. How do we follow it? And that's kind of the debate that we've been having for a long time. And it, as you say, it's been renewed since Pope Francis has come in, because many people have said, oh, well, he is the new spirit of Vatican II, and we must follow whatever he says. And other people have said, you know, there was a more balanced approach taken by John Paul and Benedict the 16th. So I'm more on that side of thinking that they had a better take on things. But we can talk about these different schools if you wish.
Well, you know what? First thing I got to call out, Dr. Deeble, is you used the S word, and that is a spirit of Vatican II.
Yes.
If there's one phrase that just seems to have, you know, sort of entered popular culture, is this idea of the spirit of Vatican II. And Vatican II also strikes me as, looking back now 50 plus years later, it was since it was all the bishops, which is hard for us to imagine, and then all of their assistants, theological expertise, I mean, it was a who's who. You go back, people who are, you know, like you just mentioned, St. John Paul the Great, you know, here's this young, at that time, he's a very young, you know, rising, you know, theologian within the church and in Poland. Mm-hmm. And there's this uneven kind of application to the teachings and all that. It plays out, Vatican II plays out, I think, very differently in Poland than it does in, say, New York City. You know, right? I mean,
that's correct. That's true.
Those kinds of things.
Well, you know, John Paul, as he was then, you know, Karol Wojtyła, the Archbishop of Krakow, he actually prepared his diocese and did sessions about what the council was about, and he applied it more in continuity with what had been before, but also with attention to the newnesses, but did not overemphasize them, and he did not pit a supposed spirit of the council against the letter itself. And I think that's the problem. I have no problem with saying that there is a spirit of the council, but it's when you say, well, there's this spirit, and of course it vitiates everything that was said in the council. That's where I think the problem has been in you know, the last 50 years.
You know, that's very interesting when you talk about St. John Paul II going back and implementing Vatican II in Krakow in kind of a maybe a more moderate sort of way. I've heard it said that it takes 100 years or so for a council to kind of truly be implemented and all of its effects be kind of laid out there for the church. So, you know, we're 50 years into that process now. If we jump 50 years into the future, obviously it's hard to predict the future, but what do you kind of see the final, you know, if Vatican II were played out the way it was intended to be and everything were implemented the way the participants kind of had in mind, which obviously there's a huge diversity of thought in that. 100 years or 50 years from now, 100 years after the council, what would you see Vatican II kind of creating as far as what the church would look like?
Well, I think that it would look a lot more traditional from the standpoint of what we would see in terms of the liturgy. I think there would still be an openness to certain of the developments. After all, the Second Vatican Council did authorize in the Latin Rite, a moderate use of English, particularly in the parts of the Mass that are not common. So I think there would be some differences. It wouldn't look like 1950, and I don't think anybody wants the church to look like 1950 in general. But what it will have is more of a traditional liturgy. It will have more of a serious attention to the scriptures themselves. I think that was something that was called for. There will be more of an attention on the part of each individual person to personal holiness as the goal and personal discipleship of Jesus Christ. And there will be a great diversity of thought about the more prudential matters, about how church and state issues go, and about, you know, how the church kind of relates to science, those kinds of things. So I think it's going to be, in 50 years, my hope is, as things settle down, we will see both what was new in the Second Vatican Council, as well as what it really preserved, the good things that were old. And I think again, it's going to look much more traditional than many people think, but it's also going to be, you know, much more different in spirit than perhaps people thought as well.
I want to take us on the other end of the time spectrum, take us in the time machine the other direction. And what are your thoughts, Dr. Deevil, around, you know, what were some of the, I want to go, because you're a Blessed John Henry Newman scholar. I've heard it said, and I'm wondering what your take on this is. I've heard it said that Newman really might be sort of that. He's certainly an incredibly important figure, but does his life or the end of his life, is that in your estimation sort of a decisive launching off point from which you begin to see the two Vatican councils sort of emerge? Is it related to him and in what ways?
Yeah, well, Newman is not cited very often in the Second Vatican Council, but a lot of people see his hand in terms of his balanced approach to subjects such as in Dei Verbum, the Constitution on the Word of God. This very balanced approach in seeing that there's one Word of God, and it is manifested in both Scripture and tradition, but they're not two streams of thought, two independent things, but there's a unity that is developing throughout time. And that's very Newmanian. Many of the other ideas, too, of seeing the Pope as certainly having a final jurisdiction and an ability to speak infallibly, but also seeing him amidst his brothers, those are also very Newmanian. It's that balance that's there. You know, you suggest that perhaps the end of Newman's life is a sort of preview, and I think that's true, because I think much of what is good in the council documents does reflect a Newmanian viewpoint, but also what is perhaps rotten in the spirit of Vatican II school also reflects some of the ways in which Newman was interpreted. Many people looked at him and went in the direction of what was known as modernism, this sort of loose school of thought by which people interpreted basically religion in general and the faith in particular as sort of human manifestations of a divine that we really can't know, and therefore we can't be too clear on things, that would be too rigid. So I do think we see that as a reality, that how Newman was taken at the end of his life is in a way how the Second Vatican Council was taken, either as a balanced and organic whole that is still guided by God, or as a sort of fuzzy set of rules that can be interpreted any way you want because they don't really make contact with real revelation. Newman always was certain that revelation itself is clear, and are the doctrines, the dogmas that we have, they actually get at the truth about God. They aren't complete, but we can trust them. The same goes with the documents of Vatican II. Some people said, well, you know, we can't, you know, these are only a beginning, and we need to really sort of let go of those and run with the Spirit. A Newmanian take is that, no, when the Church speaks in council, its ordinary way of teaching infallibly, you take that. And although it doesn't cover everything, there have to be new councils, it does cover what God wants it to cover at the time. So... I think that's a good point.
You're listening to the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. We are talking with Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies, Dr. David Deevil from the University of St. Thomas, way up there in Minnesota. And we are talking about Vatican II. You know, probably the most visible aspect of Vatican II is the liturgical reform that came after it. And, you know, the liturgical reform movement started prior to Vatican II, much earlier. How much did that movement, you know, I think of like the Schoenstatt movement coming out of Germany, other movements wanting to reform the liturgy. How much did that movement, I guess, kind of filter into the documents that came out of Vatican II? And how much of that, I guess, gets overblown and is kind of overemphasized when you look at Vatican II?
Yeah, I think there had been a move for a long time to think more holistically about the liturgy. You know, like I said, if you look 50 years from now, I think things will look more traditional, but it's not just simply a matter of getting rubrics right or getting, you know, the perfect form of the prayer or the perfect form of the rite as it was done in 1570 or 422 or whatever. There is a sense that worship has to be alive. The liturgy is a living thing, and that was a theme of many of these liturgical reformers that came before, and they did influence the way in which the council talked about liturgy, and they influenced it in the direction of seeing it as the living action of Christ, the whole Christ with his people together, and that there was an importance in what the laity did. They weren't just there to be, you know, a sort of audience, but instead they were there to assist at Mass truly. And what they did was important in terms of how they received the liturgy and the truth of Christ into their lives. I think some of their themes, like noble simplicity, got overplayed, and many people took that to mean, well, we've got to get rid of all of the statues, and we've got to get rid of repetitions and things like that. That, I think, has been very problematic because, you know, if liturgy is about this relationship with the Father and a statement of love, it's kind of like with your wife. You know, you don't say, well, I told you I love you, I'm not going to repeat that again.
Or, right, you know, what do you or need, take all their pictures
do
down.
New to wear for? You've got something perfectly fine. No, when we're in love, right, then we actually decorate and we repeat. And that's what the liturgy is all about. And many of those themes kind of got mangled in the Vatican II process. I think in the document itself, it's called Sacro Sanctum Concilium, this sacred council speaking on the liturgy. It's fairly clear in most places, but there are ambiguities, and many people took those ambiguities to mean, now we have to make everything look completely different. If it was chant before, now it's folk songs. And I think that was a great mistake.
The tambourine and guitars.
Simplify, yeah. And change all the musical styles and still have something that people recognize. And I think many of the liturgical reformers who came before the council were very upset at what took place after the council, even if they were fairly happy with the document itself.
Well, that brings up a point I've often wondered myself about and having conversations over the years with others. Could you put your finger on where the change in architecture comes from? Because I don't really see much reference, if any, in any of the documents. But as this, you know, to a certain extent, the crazier stuff I would call kind of a hijacking of the intentions of the council. But there's this whole there is what you mentioned, Dr. Deevil, this, you know, the removal of sacred art and some of that. But then you begin to have the church buildings themselves go completely squirrely, I would say, into, you know, almost like, you know, conference halls, you know.
Or even worse, barns.
Barns, yeah. Well, that goes with the folk signs, you know. But yeah. where does the architectural changes? I get the stripping of the altars, but then there's it mushrooms to then into a sphere that includes architecture itself and the church buildings themselves.
I think that's part of this general theme. Many people have talked about the Second Vatican Council in terms of two themes: aggiornamento, or updating, or, you know, making things modern, and ressourcement, returning to the sources. And I think many people who emphasized aggiornamento, updating, felt that you had to sort of make the church move with the times and make things look. So you see this, actually, even before the council. You'll see these, you know, I think Mark said, barns. There's brutalist architecture here in Minnesota. St. John's Abbey, the famous Benedictine Abbey, built a church in the 50s in the brutalist style of architecture. I mean, even a Unitarian friend of mine says, I went there and I felt like I was in the Paris airport. this is this obsession with sort of making things up to date. And the problem with that is that, you know, as Chesterton said, when you wed yourself to the spirit of the age, you're very soon a widow, because these styles come and go. So I think this was, you know, it wasn't in any of the documents that we must change all the architecture, but it was in the air. It was that sense of the spirit of Vatican II, that we have to make things in tune with the times. And I think the reality is that's not only not required by allegiance to Vatican II, but it's also very dangerous, because, trying to do that is kind of like, you know, me trying to dress like I did in high school in the 1980s. it's going to be obvious to people, not that I'm hip, right, but that I just,
you're out of touch.
I'm trying to keep up with things, and the church is not capable of doing that, and people are turned off by it.
Well, I think that's one of the tasks, right, is always to, it's finding that balance that you brought up, Dr. Deeble. It's how do we present the true, the good, and the beautiful in a way that has its proper luster, its allure, its attractiveness, that people fall in love with mm-hmm. our Lord and Holy Mother Church. And so there has to be a kind of ongoing, you know, renewal and refreshing the stories and things like that. But then without it spiraling out of control into, as you look at that Chesterton quote, you know, this horrible wedding, being wed to whatever the winds of the contemporary, you know, tastes are of the populace, which are so incredibly fickle and often vulgar.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think of the worst excesses that came after Vatican II, clown masses come to mind.
Oh, Lord. You know, Lord. So, Mark, why did you even bring that up? I've been repressing that memory.
Right.
You
have
you
all
go
of these.
Pop it up again.
You have all of these abuses. Now, you mentioned the updating. That was one of the kind of themes of the council. And, you know, here on the Catholic Cave, you know, obviously we're trying to get to some of the philosophical concepts that are kind of lurking beneath the surface.
Yeah, the ideas that fund and cause these things.
And it's always been my impression, I may be wrong on this, but it's always been my impression that one of the upshots of Vatican II was almost distancing of the church from declaring Thomistic philosophy sort of the official philosophy of the church, and an attempt to engage a little bit more with modern philosophy and some of the more modern thinkers coming out. Am I correct in that, or is that just a misperception?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you get in magisterial documents, particularly, you know, papal documents from Pope Leo the 13th on, especially a sense that the church needs to pay a special attention to the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. And that thought, what many people called the Thomistic Revival, was in effect from, you know, effectively 1890 till about 1965. And although there's never been a sort of official statement that you must be Thomistic, there was a sense that Thomas is a touchstone. Many great Thomistic philosophers like Ralph McInerney, you know, felt that the newness and the openness to different philosophical schools was a good thing. They were, you know, what the late Father Richard John Newhouse called Thomists of the strict observance, the ones who thought that, you know, Thomistic hardware could run any software. And there was a sense that this is going to be great, because now we'll have all of these other philosophical schools coming in. But really what happened was quite often that Thomism and Thomas himself were largely rejected because they were seen as a little bit too Catholic. And the upshot was that people didn't have a touchstone anymore, and so Catholic philosophy has tended to kind of, you know, totter this way and that. I think more recently there's been a return among young Catholic philosophers to the philosophy of St. Thomas in a real way, and theologians too. Matt Levering, who's a great theologian at Mundelein Seminary in Chicago, he talks about his project as ressourcement Thomism. So combining that ressourcement theme of the Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, to go back to the sources with Thomas. In other words, Thomas is still a touchstone, and we're going to combine, you know, his thought with the best that is there with the fathers of the church and with the other great doctors of the church. And I think that's the way forward, is to not dump St. Thomas and not to say Thomas alone, but to use Thomas in the way that I think Pope Leo XIII wanted him to be used, as this touchstone by which we, you know, get to the truths of the tradition, and then we supplement Thomas with all of the other thought of the church.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit, Dr. Deevil, of as I read some of Blessed John Henry Cardinal Newman around his I remember he had an admonition about how reason can run wild. Right. And that can be the source of a lot of problems, because you get, you know, bad ideas often have very bad consequences. So it seems to me that preserving St. Thomas Aquinas as that touchstone, to a certain extent, can establish some reasonable guardrails, so that we know, because we know our intellects, you know, we're sinners, right? We're fallen.
Yeah.
We can make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And we can, you know, even with the best of intentions, we can find ourselves, you know, in this area of what I think comes out of Vatican II that I described as this, you know, is it really about continuity, which is where I think we want to stay. We want to stay in continuity. So the continuity allows for development, an organic development, but we want to avoid rupture, right?
Right.
Where we literally break off through, say, novelty, into something that you know, is going to be problematic or error or potentially even heresy.
Yeah, that, you know, that language of continuity and rupture. One of the best places to find this is the famous 2005 Christmas address to the Curia, when Pope Benedict XVI first came into office, and he talked about this, about how what we needed was to have a hermeneutic, basically a theory of interpretation of reform in the one subject of the church. And a lot of people say, well, I want to be a reformer, but what they mean is not to reform something, but to make something completely new. But to be a reformer means to put the thing back into the shape it is. And he opposed that to this theory of rupture that many of the theologians of the spirit of Vatican II were putting out there, that, well, we need to start anew, that, you know, the Second Vatican Council was this new Pentecost. But of course, if you take that approach, then what are you going to do with the last 2,000 years of history? I think what many people have done who have taken that rupture thesis is they've come up with a new religion, and it's not really recognizable.
We're talking with Dr. David Deevil, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies. We're talking about Vatican II and a lot of the changes in the church that came out of it. You know, using that idea of rupture a little bit, when I talk to people, you know, lay people in the pews, etc., and they think of Vatican II, they demarcate the world as pre-Vatican II, post-Vatican II, and they do see this huge rupture, and a lot of times they talk about it in sympathetic terms as if there were huge abuses and huge problems within the church that were going on that sort of precipitated the council. Was it in response to what was perceived as sort of a crisis moment in the church? Or was it, I guess, less severe than that?
Well, I mean, that's the question. That's the million-dollar question. Some people say, well, the church actually was doing all right, and it should have, you know, perhaps they should have had a council 10 years earlier or 10 years later, and maybe things would have gone better, because as it was, when the council happened in the mid-60s, it was at this sort of euphoric time, particularly for, as the church, you know, bishops were still predominantly Western European and North and South American, But Western society was having this euphoric moment where they thought everything was possible and everything is open. And of course, what very quickly happened was we realized that things were turning sour. So, you know, it might have been wiser to have a council 10 years earlier to sort of look at what was coming, or perhaps 10 years later in the midst of the crisis. It, you know, in some ways, that's what historians say is, you know, you can't really plan for these things. But at the same time, you know, God allowed the council to happen when it did. And so we have to, you know, we have to work with what God allows as well. I don't see huge, huge problems in the church before that are not still present. I mean, people talk, you know, as you say, people say, oh, well, it's so much better now. You know, people then, they didn't even pay attention to the liturgy. And I'm thinking, well, you know, lots of people at Mass don't pay attention to the liturgy now.
Right.
You know, it's in English.
Exactly.
They're supposedly taking part of it. These are constant, and you still hear the same thing. People will brag about, well, I go to a Mass that only lasts 36 minutes and 42 seconds. And I'm thinking, well, I thought that the Second Vatican Council renewal was supposed to get us involved in the liturgy, and we're still kind of timing it so that we can get out in time to get to our favorite restaurant. So the same problems that were present before are still present afterwards. And many of the changes that were made did not affect the heart and soul of that, which is that people need to become true disciples of Christ and to love his church and serve.
And how much would you, a follow-up to Vatican II along these lines, we talked a little bit earlier, so there's this, depending on where you are, you know, in what country you're in, or what city or what parish, there's this uneven implementation or application, and how Vatican II, you know, is implemented in the United States is going to be very different than, again, a contrast would be, say, Poland. But right now it seems like when you look at some of the internal statistics of the Catholic Church, it's pretty alarming at how fast, you know, people are falling away from the faith, and, you know, the instances of, you know, either we have the nuns now, the NONES, and so there's mass attendance continued, you know, and then the mass attendance declining was prior to Vatican II, but boy, sure. it's so how much, so I often hear in some circles I travel in, you know, they lay a lot of the current ills on Vatican II, but it seems like, But how vulnerable, if at all, did Vatican II make us more vulnerable? I lay a lot of problems on secularism, quite frankly. Did Vatican II make us more, we opened up the windows, it was one of the expressions, let the air in. Did that in a certain sense allow some of the smoke, if you will, of Satan in the secular culture come in with what should have been fresh air? And then maybe made us more vulnerable, Holy Mother Church more vulnerable to some of the cultural ills that we find ourselves in today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, that phrase, the smoke of Satan, that was Paul VI himself, who was the Pope at the end of the Second Vatican Council. And in 1972, he said, the smoke of Satan has entered even the halls of the church.
Oh, Lord!
You know, I mean, you know, when the Pope says this, you know that there's a problem here. But I wonder about that. It's, the problem is not whether the church is going to be open to the currents of the time, but it's how it's going to be open. I think it's that, you know, it's that notion that the church should be completely open and receive everything without discernment is the problem that happened. The people who were the spirit of Vatican II sorts generally wanted to cast aside the letter of the documents and the letter of church teaching for the most part from the last 2,000 years. And when they did that, I think, as I said before, what you often ended up with was something that was more like a new religion. You know, the church is, you know, our Lord's parable about, you know, the steward who's capable of bringing both new things and old to bear in his work is what the church is. And the church is always going to be doing a combination of taking the newest stuff in the 13th century, the newest stuff, St. Thomas Aquinas was helping with it, was taking old stuff, the new translations of Aristotle, the new documents. But it's also doing things with the old stuff, rediscovering what's at her heart. I think that, you know, if there had been much more attention to the ressourcement thinking, the going back to the sources, reading the fathers of the church, reading those medievals, there wouldn't have been as much of a problem of letting too many things in because you wanted to be concerned to be updating or relevant. So again, it's the balance. It's the church is always a both and creature, and when she ceases to do one or the other, we have problems. And you know, some people said before the council, the problem was, well, the church wasn't open enough to new things. Now the church isn't open enough to old things, I think, in many ways, in many sectors. And of course, as you point out, it differs from place to place.
You know, we've mentioned the spirit of Vatican II, and you know, the other spirit, though, that I think affects how it's been implemented is the spirit of the times. I mean, when Vatican II happened in 1965, this country was still a fairly Christian country. Western Europe was still fairly Christian and Catholic. You know, the church to a certain extent was spreading. Now, people have described the climate as post-Christian, particularly in Europe, but also here in the United States. How much does that spirit of the times, how much has that, I guess, changed the way Vatican II looks now, and maybe has changed the trajectory of how it's being implemented?
Right. Well, I mean, as I said, since it happened in the 60s, and there was this sort of you still had a Christian culture, broadly speaking, in Europe and North and South America. And so there was this sense that, particularly in the document Gaudium et Spes, which is basically about the sort of the social vision of the church, you have this sort of notion that, well, you know, now the church and the world can kind of combine. And now that things have, as I said before, turned a little bit sour, now that you have a rejection, a growing secularism, I think what needs to be brought out more are the contrast points, that the church is a contrast society, and that, you know, our Lord actually didn't promise us that things would work out and that we would, you know, that things
right.
would always be easy, but instead he promised that if, you know, if the master received such treatment as he did and he was crucified, the servant's probably going to expect the same thing. So I think that, you know, as we continue to look at the Second Vatican Council and the whole history of the church, we need to see a real view of where we are in the times. And now I think what we need is more contrast. In the 60s, everybody wanted to sort of blend in more with the society. Priests shouldn't wear, you know, any distinctive garb. Religious should, you know, wear no distinctive garb. You know, you get what people have referred to as the pantsuit nuns. Dressed as if they're on a Hawaiian vacation. Or
right, 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 right. The Hillary Clinton pantsuits.
What people want to see today is they want to see those signs of distinction, and you know, they not just in religious and priests, but they want to see them in us too. You know, not that we have to wear a lot of clunky crucifixes or something like that. But, you know, even the sense that there is something different about us, that we actually pause to pray before meals, that we actually, you know, have children, you know, because God wants them and we raise them in that faith. I think the contrast points are what need to be brought out more and more as we look at how to implement what that last council was, and less looking to the idea that we can very easily sort of blend our world and the church together.
We've been talking with Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies from the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, Dr. David Deevil. And the time has flown by. We're unfortunately kind of running towards the end of our time. What kind of resources are out there? If people are interested in following up on this topic and looking a little bit deeper into to Vatican II, what the council was, what when people use the term the spirit of Vatican II, what exactly they mean, where would you guide people to look for further reading and further resources?
Well, I'd tell them to read the documents themselves. I mean, there are some very, you know, they're available online, and they're very good versions. I remember reading them for the first time when I was still a Protestant. I found them, you know, for a committee document, they were just amazing, and they had this broad biblical sweep. So I'd say tell people to read those documents themselves and look at them and see what they really say, because then the next time somebody tells you, well, Vatican II commanded that clowns be at Mass. You know, you can say, no, that's not there at all. But then after you look at that, I think some of the great places to look are the works of people like Pope Benedict, especially in his, you know, his theological writings as Cardinal Ratzinger. There's a lot of great stuff that he has written about this proper appreciation of the Council. Another book that I'd recommend, I mentioned Matt Levering, the guy who talks about ressourcement Thomism. He has a book from Oxford University Press from last year called Vatican II, Renewal Within Tradition. And what he's arguing there is that the real problem is that many people have looked at Vatican II simply as a historical event, and they've tried to get the meaning from it. And what he opposes to that is trying to see the Church as Christ acting in history. And then if I can mention one more book, I have a couple of essays in a fairly new version, edition of a book called Slaying the Spirit of Vatican II with the Light of Truth.
I love that. We're going to need a copy of that, Doctor.
Yeah,
Ken will get you our address.
It's a great book. The late Father Robert Arujo, who was a great Jesuit legal and theological scholar, was one of the main contributors. I wrote something. Father John Zuhlsdorf has chapters.
Oh, yeah.
A number of very good people. And it's a good volume of essays by different people trying to get at what the real spirit is and not this sort of false spirit. So I think those are some great places to start. I will put my essays in there on my academia page. I have a page in which I put articles and book chapters. It's stthomas.academia.edu/David Deevil. You can just search for it on there, academia.edu, David Deevil. You can find my articles in there. So,
oh, fantastic! I've got to offer one thing out though too. Now that you've given us some grounding in solid Catholic theology as it pertains to the Council. So to go to the other end of the spectrum for the really crazy, I'm going to recommend people. You can get this out. You watch the movie Conflict. Okay, it's 1973. It's Martin Sheen. Okay, and what it's about is, there's this monastery in Ireland where they're holding out to the Tridentine Mass, and the Vatican hears about it. You know this movie?
Yes.
And they sent Martin Sheen.
I think his name was Brian Moore. Yes, I've seen that. It's very interesting.
It is crazy. So they send in Martin Sheen, who's a priest from the Vatican. Of course, he's in, you know, hipster clothes.
I'm picturing Apocalypse Now with Martin Sheen going.
Oh, it's hilarious because he's horrified to find out that they're still praying in Latin and things like that. Right. He's got to eradicate that. You know, it is the kookiest stuff. I mean, that's the spirit of Vatican II in the worst sense. I mean, so to read the solid resources first, so then you can get the contrast of this kooky movie. And there's other ones out there, but this one is my all-time favorite of how just nuts things can get.
Yeah, the late Ralph McInerney wrote a number of, he was a novelist as well as a philosopher, and he had a number of novels set in that period that captured. One of them called The Priest was a bestseller. And it has that same sort of conflict feel. And it's, of course, you know, for your listeners in the Indiana area, it's set in the fictional Fort Elbow, Indiana, or something like that. So it's got that home feel to that conflict as it happened in the early 70s.
You know, he's one of my favorite authors. I love Ralph McInerney, rest his soul. He also was, I have an uncle who's a retired priest, Holy Cross priest, who, when he was taking his, when he was doing his undergrad in philosophy at Notre Dame, Ralph Mac in 1953, I think it was, Ralph McInerney was his philosophy professor for my uncle.
Yeah.
So that's my link way back then.
Well, he was there for like 50 years and contributed much philosophically as well as artistically to our understanding of that. Of an interesting time.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Deevil, we are unfortunately just about out of time. Time flies. But thank you so much for being here in the cave with us today, talking a little bit about Vatican II. And we invite all our listeners to follow up. Dr. Deevil, once again, what was the website that you had mentioned where you have some of your articles?
It's academia.edu. And if you search for me, academia.edu, and then search for my name, Deevil, you'll be able to find me there, David Deevil. So.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you so much for being in the Catholic Cave. We're going to have you back real soon.
Sounds good. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mark.
All right. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Keep Jesus at the center of our day all day long by having those words in the background.
It touches lives. It does every day.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And we just got done with a fantastic interview with Dr. David Deevil, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies from University of St. Thomas, talking about Vatican II. And really, not just the changes that came about, but really where it came from. What the history was leading up to it, and more importantly, where the church is headed now after Vatican II. What can we expect? You know, it's been 50 years since the council. What can we expect 50 years from now once the council has finally kind of been implemented and the dust is settled? Because it takes about 100 years, they say, for a council like that to be fully implemented.
Yeah, I'm wondering, though, a couple of things. One would be, now that we have the age of technology that we live in, social media, ready access, I wonder if it doesn't get fully baked maybe a little bit faster than 100 years. It seems like other kind of movements are accelerating through technology. I'm not sure. It's just a kind of open question on that.
Yeah, yeah. The effect of technology on how fast change spreads, to me, is an open question. I mean,
how fast it spreads and how deep it spreads.
How fast and deep. But on the other hand, it may not affect it as much as we think. It may still take a long time because it really is. I think it's more a matter of human experience absorbing it than it is the message getting spread. So, yeah. You know, and with Vatican II, I kind of get that feel about it, that we're still in the midpoint of its full sort of
right.
implementation and effects, and trying to wrinkle out some of the rough edges of how it, you know, get rid of the clown masses and maybe rethink the idea of a banjo being up there at mass. So, you know, wrinkle out some of those rough edges.
I'll tell you what, but I think though might happen though, before that 100, before we hit the 100 years, it seems historically we're about due for a council anyway. So what could happen is before this whole thing fully bakes, another council happens. And some of the things that might, not just the amount of time that's already passed, the 50 plus years, which is about the when councils begin to begin to be talked about being convened. But I also think with Pope Francis, there's this persistence of some of the, you know, with some of the cardinals and et cetera around some of his writings and some of the ambiguities. And ambiguity, to me, is one of those seedlings for a council, because councils have often been called, probably most frequently called, to settle matters of ambiguity. So
right.
I almost feel like that's in the air.
And as Dr. Deevil mentioned, one of the issues that was supposed to be settled by Vatican II was the relationship of the bishops to the Holy Father, and trying to kind of establish, I guess, lanes of authority between individual bishops, these council, you know, these national councils like the U.S. Catholic Council of Bishops, trying to kind of sort out a little bit where the authority really lies after Vatican I. So, you know, Vatican II in a lot of ways was a continuation of Vatican I, talking about authority within the church. And you're right. And with some of the controversy over Pope Francis's writings, the response that some of the bishops have given back to the Holy Father in regards to those writings, there seems to be kind of a bubbling going
right,
that's
on. That's
all I'm saying. And it may lead to a third Vatican Council to try to kind of continue this dialogue about authority.
Or it could be, since they're named often after the city they're held in, it could be like, instead of the third Vatican, they hold it in Milwaukee. We could have a completely different name.
And then thousands of years.
The first Milwaukee Council.
Thousands of years from now, people will be talking about the Milwaukeean Council.
All right. I think that about wraps it up for this week on The Catholic Cave. For Mr. Mark Tuttle, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Lamford, and until next time, may God bless. The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.